Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Anne Cleaves, and we're here this morning to celebrate our international guest of honour, Håkan Nesser. When I told my Swedish publisher that I was coming to interview Håkan, she said she was dead impressed. He's one of the most respected writers in Sweden. A pause. And very tall. Both those things are certainly true, and I hope this morning we'll find out a little bit more about him too. Let's talk first about Van Veeteren, because he's your central character. He's featured in the four books which are available here in the UK. Some of us read an interview in the Sunday Times last week, and it implied there that he was as gloomy as Henning Mankell's Kurt Wallander. Hardly possible, I'd have thought.
No.
But tell us a bit about Van Veeteren.
I'll try, but first of all, let me tell you that I find it a little bit awkward to analyse my own writing, and I've been doing this for at least 15 years, but it's every time I feel the same kind of small awkwardness, because there is always a discrepancy between what I write and what I say, and if you find this discrepancy disturbing, please forget everything I said and stick to the book. I think this goes for every writer, but you need to point it out from time to time. I prefer books to writers, actually. The question about Van Veeteren, yes, I used him for 10 books, or he used me for 10 books. Yes, he's a gloomy guy, but when I set out to write about him, I had no idea that I was writing a series, first of all. I had the idea that I had a good story, and organically is a word that is misused these days, but he sort of developed organically, because I didn't even realize that anybody would want to publish this book, but I wanted to write the story anyway, and after like 25 pages, I needed a detective, and then I had few questions in my head. What's he going to be like? And I wanted him traditional. I think that I had just read Anne Holt. You're familiar with Anne Holt, the Norwegian writer? And she had just invented her heroine, and she's a lesbian woman, and she rides a pink Harley Davidson motorbike. And I realized that I can never top this. So let's create a gloomy, traditional sleuth. A bit like Morse, a bit like, or not create, but I mean, I wanted him to be literally traditional, and I wanted him to be, at least to start with, depressed, because I like.
But he does have a
people.
Sense of humour, doesn't he, Van Veeteren? He has a sense of humour.
Yes, it's if you are a depressive type, you need your humour. I mean, happy people, they don't need the humour. It's the depressed guys that they need their humour, and he has a kind of a black humour, of course. But he's not in a good mood in the first book, and I think his journey is downwards until book number 5, and then it's a bit upward again. He finds a woman, of course, eventually, but I think I leave him after book number 10 in a better mood than he was in the first book. This is also about over 10 years, so yes, hopefully.
The books have been published here not in the order in which they were written. So we started off with Borkman's Point, then The Return, The Mind's Eye, and now The Woman with the Birthmark. But you wrote them in a different order, I think.
No, I wrote them in the right order. but it's because you want to start with a hit, and you realize, well, he got the Swedish prize for book number 2, so let's start with number 2. But I think you got 2, 3, 4, and 1. Oh, 2, 3, 1, 4. So now you're back on track.
Right.
Norway, for instance, they started with number 7, which was a big hit in Scandinavia, and then they're lost forever. But I mean, you can read every book, of course, as a standalone. But there is a point in reading them in roughly the correct order.
And I know we've got some distinguished translators in the audience. What do you make of the English translation of your
I think
books?
It's very good, but. I just pretend to speak English, and I remember when Laurie Thompson, who is my translator, he sent me the first 2 or 3 chapters from Borkman's Point, and he asked me to could I could I comment on these and say, what do you think about it? And I did. I asked him a lot of questions. Shouldn't you use the ing form? Shouldn't you use another expression here? And I wrote him like 3 or 4 pages with suggestions.
I bet you're really popular.
Yeah, but then I just, usually his emails are very full. I mean, he can write pages in the middle of the night, but then I just did one sentence back. Håkan, I thought you knew English. Laurie. So I think it's a good try. I know it's because people tell me it's, but I can't judge it. And if you're translated, you have to believe that you're in good hands. And in this case, I'm quite certain that I am, because I mean the reviewers, they always remark on that it's a good translation. You can't see it's a translation sometimes.
Good. The Van Vieteren novels are set in a sort of unspecified European country. You grew up in Sweden, in Uppsala. 3 years ago, you left to move to Greenwich Village in New York, and now you're based in London, at least for the winters, you say. Why did you desert Sweden in your books as well as physically? Why choose somewhere else to set those novels?
The fictive country, yes. This is a question that I've had for every time I have a question. This is the one that you get. And there is the true story is that when I had written the first two chapters of the first book in the Van Vieteren series, the Mind's Eye, I realized that there should be geography around, but I think that I didn't have time to research or to put it in some place in Sweden. So I just made up a country, just ad hoc, just intuitively. But perhaps I had in mind also that it's a good idea because. For instance, when you do, I think the level of existentiality gets higher if you have this fictitious country. I mean, for instance, when you do drama, when you do Shakespeare or Greek tragedy, you don't put a lot of stuff on the scene. You just put the thing, all the characters and the drama. And then when it's nothing in the background, it gets more clear in a way. So perhaps I had this in mind when I sort of took this shortcut in the first book. And then when I had this, I just invented the city, Mardam. The country has no name. This is very annoying to German readers. I mean, as you know, that we are Swedish crime writers. We're immensely popular in Germany, but they want to know where they are. And they ask me every time, so where is Mardam? And then they found out that in Emden, I told, if you listened to me yesterday, I mean, there is a town in Germany close to the Dutch border called Emden, and there is a part of the town, it's called Nesserland. And they found out, so this is where you are in Emden. And I said, well, okay, it's fine with me to be in Emden, but it is fictitious, and it's somewhere in the Northern Europe, but geography is important. Perhaps it's so important that you have to invent it. And I know that if I had put Van Vieteren in some place in Sweden, the limits would have been too much for me. I could never have created 10 books in Sweden with Van Vieteren. It wouldn't have worked for some reason.
So it gives you the space to explore. I mean, you can create what you need for your plot and for your characters.
Exactly. But you need to remember what you did in the last books. Also, because Mardam, and when I realized that this is going to be a series, and they published the first book, and then they published the second book, and I realized that I want to write 10 books. 10, it's a good number, but I need to remember not only how old my characters are, and you have the same problem, I know, if you write a series, you have to be careful. But I thought that I needed to draw a map over this non-existent country, which I did. But I lost it, and I never searched for it. So obviously, I've never needed it. It's all in my head, and it's worked so far. And I mean, I have German readers, as you know. So they would, if you make a mistake, it takes 2 weeks, and then you have a letter. And but I have these letters, but not when it comes to the geography of this fictitious country. So it works in a way. Yes. And also, it's kind of democracy. I mean, because it's a. A book is something between a writer and a reader, and the reader gets more active. The more you have to create, the more active the reader gets. And if you have to create the country, you're and I like that idea.
But yes, of course that idea of leaving space for the reader to do their own creative stuff is important.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. The most recent book, The Woman with the Birthmark, is just out here now, and if you haven't read it, go out and buy it, because it's very good. We were discussing in the green room, and I said, well, it's a book about a serial killer, but we feel some sympathy with the killer. And you said, no, it's not a serial killer.
Now, to me, a serial killer is somebody who kills randomly. I mean, you can kill redhead people or young girls or whatever, but you don't have your victims picked out from the beginning. And in this case, she knows that she's going to kill these four people and for a particular reason, so she's not a serial killer. I don't know about the definition of a serial killer, but to me, a serial killer is a random killer.
And we end up at the end of the book feeling some sympathy for your killer.
Hopefully, yes.
That's what you intended.
Yes. Perhaps I said this in the Sunday Times interview also. I remember when they filmed my books, and this film was... I remember when they broadcast it in Sweden, I went to the post office the Monday after the Saturday when the last episode had been on TV, and the woman in the cashier, she recognized me, and she said to me, "I'm so glad she killed number four, too." Well, I said, now you're in moral trouble, aren't you? And she said, yes, but some killings are better than other killings, or whatever she said. Yeah, you have the sympathy, of course, for the... And sometimes you should have sympathy for the murderer, I think.
Where did the book come from? How did it start? Where did the idea come from?
Well, this is 15 years ago. I don't hardly remember. But, I mean, thank God it's an automatic process. I mean, it's analyzing your own... I mean, writing is such a complicated process, but analyzing your own writing is even more complicated. But generally, you have this idea which is close to nothing, and then it's a story, and a story that sort of seeks its form, and if it doesn't find its form, it dies. So this is the way... But I wanted it to be a good... sympathetic murderer, and I don't know how it started actually, but I mean, I realized that when I liked the book, when I wrote it, and to me, writing and reading is basically the same thing, because what you're doing as a writer, when you write your book, you're reading it, and you want to continue to read it, so it boils down to the same kind of experience. The experience of writing and reading is the same, really. And if you, as a writer, don't enjoy what you're writing, well, how would the readers enjoy it? It's as easy as that, I think.
I think so. We all write the sort of books that we enjoy reading, and that's how we choose what we're going to write. I think that's certainly true. So you spend half a year in London, half a year in Sweden, or maybe just the summer in Sweden. When do you do your writing, and what's your writing routine? Are you a 1,000 words a day man, or...
No, I wish I had routines. It's when I get older, but I realize that I'm not I'm getting older. But I've written 22 novels, and the system is that I'm a periodical. I mean, I write when you have a lot of stuff in your head, I write it, and then when you have nothing in your head, I don't sit down to try to squeeze something out of your empty head. So I write very fast and very much when I'm writing, and then. But it's like this actually, and I write in the mornings. The ideal thing is to have a jet lag. Then when you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I mean, you know what it is like, and you can't sleep, and you're alone in the world, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and that's what I would like to do. What I'd like to do my writing at 3 o'clock in the morning, but I'm not sure it's tax deductible to fly across the Atlantic just to get your jet lag. But early in the morning.
Early in the morning.
I walk with the dog, and while you're thinking, and then you write for 4 or 5 hours, and then you take care of the rest of the stuff you need to do as a housewife or whatever.
I think you're very good at small domestic details, very good on children, and good too. I think I can't remember which book it. There are some scenes in a school, and I think you're very good at that. Where did those come from? Are you an eavesdropper, or how do you pick up those small details that bring the books to life?
Well, I don't know, but I was a teacher for 20 years. I must have picked up something. when it comes to, I try to avoid writing about teachers, but I realize that there is a strange teacher in most of my books because I met so many, and even young people. But I try to avoid it. I try to avoid make them murderers. Well, of course, you pick things up. But I never wear a notebook and take things down. It comes, and I think this is a kind of a. It's a democratic thing also, because if you as a writer, if you're not able to hold everything in your head, how will the reader be able to hold it in his or her head when he or she is reading it? So I don't take a lot. Do you take a lot of notes?
No, I've said exactly the same thing when people have asked me how I do it. No, I don't plot in advance. I don't make notes. And I think that...
But you have a plan.
Only in my head, and only very, very rough. I don't know where I'm going when I start writing.
Because I asked Anne before, we talked in the green room and about the an early decision you have to make if you're a crime writer. I mean, half of my books are mainstream, and to me it's not, the label is not important. I want to tell a good story, whether it's a crime story or a mainstream novel, it doesn't matter. But if you write a crime story and you know it's a crime story from the start, one decision is, What from what perspectives will I write this story? From the police officers or from some of the people involved? And in your first book, Raven Black, and I think we can talk about this because I suppose that you've all read it and enjoyed it. You enter the head of the murderer without us noticing that you are entering the head of the murderer. But this must have been something that you knew before you got there, or what?
No, I didn't, actually.
Oh, you did.
No, I didn't. No, I started writing it, and about a third of the way through, I thought, oh, she could be the murderer. That would be fun.
Really? But
yeah.
To me, this is... I think you're lying, because this is... This is what crime writers always say. You start out blank and you don't know anything. You're just the sort of tool for something divine, and you just do the writing and it comes sort of automatically.
No, I don't do divinity, but...
No, well, it could come from the other... I don't know from where, but that you didn't even plan...
So you know before you start writing how it's going to end?
No, but I mean, I have a rough plan. And I think I know that the merger is when I start out. But if you, at a certain point of your writing, realize that, well, this is even better, and this is what happened to you.
Yeah.
But did you really write a few... But did you have another murderer until you entered...
No, it was open. When I first start writing the first few chapters, I don't know. It could be anybody.
Oh, really?
And it just develops.
But do you do that all the time?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, well, to me it's scary, because when you come to the last chapter and you don't know who...
But Hawcombe, unlike you, when I started writing, I was making very, very little money.
Oh.
So it had to be fun.
Yeah.
And if I knew how it was going to end, where would the fun be in that?
Oh, yeah, sure. But I'll tell you, my first book was included very little money also. But it didn't have a murderer, so probably you're right. No, I agree. I mean, it would be, to me... I mean, some writers, they start with the last chapter and then they try to go back and then they try to find their way to the last chapter. And to me, this would be so boring. I can't believe it, because the magical thing about writing is it's as good as reading, but also that you have this... You realize that where is this story going? And while you're writing, you have to have your doors and the windows of your mind open, and you take every impression, you realize, oh, I can do it like this, and you can hear a voice saying, and you listen to it, and some, yes, it's good. And you make so many decisions intuitively while you're writing, and this is what's so fantastic about it. Yeah. Could I just tell you a thing that happened to me? I was writing, I think it's number 5 in the Van Veeteren series, and then I was writing chapter 7, or I always write chronologically. And then I heard a voice saying, write something about a woman on a bicycle in a yellow... raincoat now.
Had you been drinking a lot?
No, I never. And this was in the morning, and I hadn't been drinking, and I asked the voice, why? But I had no answer. And I wrote this sentence, and at the same time, a woman in a yellow raincoat came on a bike and crossed the square or whatever, and then I continued writing. And then 5 chapters later, I realized why this woman in the yellow raincoat was important in chapter 8. And these things tend to happen when you're writing, and this is the reward. Apart from the money you get from selling your books, I think it's such a strange process, this kind of writing. I mean, half of you are writers, you know what I'm talking about, I suppose. So, but it's rewarding. But it means also that you have to write organically, that the story is important, and to me, the story is important, and the writer and the reader should sit in the same grip of the story, sort of. Because I believe that there is, when you come to a certain point in your writing, you realize that this really happened. I mean, these characters exist. And I know that these people that Anne is writing about, of course he exists. It's obvious. And I asked Anne before, will you stop after book number 4? And I will ask the same question again, but perhaps she's supposed to interview me.
I'm supposed to interview you. We can discuss that another time.
Okay.
So, you're telling me that it's the story that's really important for you. And again, looking at the Sunday Times article, you were saying that you're not really a political writer, that the other Swedish crime writers that we know very well, like Larsson and Mankell, write from a very obvious political standpoint. But you don't. But you do have some sort of a social viewpoint, I think, very humane. Can you talk a bit about where the writing comes from, the sort of moral standpoint from which you write? Because we talked a bit about that with the woman with the birthmark.
Well, if you're a serious writer, that's where you end up. I mean, if you want to write or to read a good story, I mean, you have to read about people who are somehow in a bad position. I mean, what's the point of writing about the rich and the wealthy and so, I mean, this is where you end up with it. And I think that also of course, I'm a moral writer. And I think crime fiction is a genre where morality is higher than in mainstream fiction. Because you try to create a balance between good and evil. And that's what you're doing, actually. At least trying to explain why people behave badly. Yes.
Did you come to any answers? I think you were saying that in one sense you had great sympathy for the killer in the woman with the birthmark. So does that excuse her murder, the fact that she has a reason for...
Yes, more or less, I think it does. I mean, she's... but, I mean, it's never black or white, it's grey. And, I mean, you shouldn't kill people, of course, but, I mean, some murders are... And it's interesting to read about it because it's the moral thing is that perhaps I would, if I would have been in her position, I would have done the same. And I remember I used to tell my daughter when she was a small kid, if somebody ever tries to rape you, before they do it, tell the rapist that my father is going to kill you. and this is also, I tell this to girls at school, tell them something about this. You know that when you're doing this, my father will kill you for this. And I think perhaps, I'm not sure because I luckily I never came into that position, but I might have. I'm not sure. And most of us have never been in a position where we sort of need to kill for some reason. But I think obviously, and the good, I think the really good stories, the really good crime stories is where you explain the crime in this sense, that this is a person who for this or that reason really need to kill somebody.
In Borkman's point as well, the murderer is a very sympathetic character, I think.
Yeah.
And again, we understand why he's killed. Do you, in any of your books, have a character who is evil?
Oh, yeah,
who kills
yes.
for the fun of it or because he enjoys violence?
No, I realized in the Van Veeteren series, after writing about 3 or 4 sympathetic killers, And somebody wrote a review in a Swedish paper, said that Nesser, he likes murderers, that I try to create some unsympathetic killers too, of course. So, for instance, there are two really bad guys in number 9 and 10, for sure. And I don't try to explain the motives behind their killings. Well, a little bit, but not it's not a central part of the books.
So we don't get to feel that sympathy or that empathy that we get with in the early Van Veeteren novels for the killers. You've written another series in Swedish set this time in Sweden, not in a fictitious country. And again a cop, and he's called Barbarotti. Can you tell us a bit about him? Let's pitch him, and we can all write to the publisher and say, bring Barbarotti into it.
Yes, his name is Gunnar Barbarotti, which is a strange name because the first part, Gunnar, is a very Swedish or Nordic name, and Barbarotti is obviously Italian. I did not intend to write a new series, and when the Van Veeteren series was finished, I got the same question, will you start on a new series now? And I said, no, never. I will write fiction and crime fiction, but never again a series. And then for a couple of years, I wrote standalones, a few novels, but then I got stuck in a book that is called Man Without Dog. And it's a family drama, really, and it's, I try to write it sort of Virginia Woolf style, where I go from, it's a family, they have a birthday party just before Christmas, 10, 11 people, three generations, and I write it from different perspectives, and it works fairly well up to page 200. And then I realized that this is the point where I should need an inspector, and I don't want an inspector. It was not a writer's block, but you come to a point where you, well, how do I carry on from this point? And what I do is just put it away, forget about it, let your mind revolve around this sort of automatically. But nothing happened for a week, 2 weeks, 2 months. And this is 200 pages. What a waste, I thought. But then I had a knock on a door in my head, and I opened the door slightly ajar, and there was a man outside, and he said, "Hello, I'm Gunnar Barbarotti. I'm an inspector in Chimlinge." This is a fictitious place in Sweden, but it's on top of Borås, it's close to Gothenburg. And he said, "I can help you." And I let him in, and he told me about his strange name, Gunnar Barbarotti, and he also told me about his strange relationship to God. He has a very, very particular deal with God. And when you read the book in Swedish, you will find... I won't bother you with this now, but...
Oh,
but anyway,
tell us, because we're not going to read it in Swedish and it won't be available
but it's,
in English
no,
for
ages. No, it'll take
region.
A few years. But but it's... it's a thing. It's a thing between him and God. And God has to prove that he exists. How should I... Because he has a meeting with God in his bedroom after his divorce, and he's very depressed. And what's the reason for me to go on living? And then
another Swedish.
And then God comes into his bedroom 4 o'clock in the morning, "You're not here," says Barbarotti. And God says, "I'm here. You can see me. I can't see you," says Barbarotti. Prove to me that you exist. And how do you want me to prove it? And he says, "Well, answer my prayers," says Barbarotti. And then they have this deal that for 10 years, Barbarotti will say his prayers, and if the prayer is fulfilled, God will get 1 point, or in more important cases, 2 points or even 3 points. But if it's not fulfilled, he get -1. And then Barbarotti is doing the books. So sometimes God is -11, and then he doesn't exist. And at some points he's +4, and then he's, and sometimes he's 0, and then you don't know. So this is the deal he has with God. And it works very well for the first 2 or 3 books. And also in book number 4 and 5, it will become more important. I mean, because this is a joke, of course, but I want to... This question about whether there is a God or not is important to me. But anyway, I accepted this Barbarotti when he came to me like this. And I said, "Okay, I'll use you," I said. And then he said, "Stop, I'm a complex person. One book is not enough. You need more than one book." So, and I said, "How many?" And he said, "4. Listen to the word, the Barbarotti Quartet." And I said, "Yes, he has a point." But now I realize that there is going to be a Barbarotti Quintet. And that's why I asked Anne Cleves about a Shetland quartet or quintet, but she refuses to answer.
So why Barbarotti? Is he Italian, or his family is Italian?
His father is Italian, but when the boy was about to be born, his parents, the father is Italian and the mother is Swedish, they disagree on everything, but one thing, and that is that they will divorce. But the father said that, "I want to give a real good name to my son. He's going to be Giuseppe Barbarotti," which is his own name, but The mother says that never. You think this guy is coming to a Swedish school with a spaghetti name? He will be bullied from the first day. So he's going to hear something Nordic. And then they fight about this. And then the father says, "If you don't obey, I'll marry you." And this is a threat, of course. And then she says, "Okay, let's make a compromise." And so it's Gunnar and it's Barbarotti. I think the Italian, they bought this book just because of the name, I think. So it's published in quite successfully. But Barbarotti isn't, nobody would be called Barbarotti in Italy because it's a very weird Italian sounding name only.
Well, I hope we get Gunnar in English. We've just got the four Van Veeteren books. What happens next? What will be the next Van Veeteren book that we'll get?
I'm not sure. I think they bought, hopefully, number five, which is The Inspector and the Silence or something. But, I mean, they could pick any book, so I'm not sure. I hope you get Carambol quite soon, because that's a good one.
What happens in that?
I can't tell you, but it's to me, it's sometimes when you write, you realize that this story is... this story is so good that it should have had a better writer, almost.
I don't believe that. But Van Veeteren continues in the books even after he stops becoming a detective, doesn't he? What
yeah,
happens
after,
him?
Because he's quite, I mean, he's in his early 60s. I think he's 55 in the first books and he's 65 in the last book. But he's... And he's not a happy person. And after book number five, he retires. He buys himself a bookstore instead, and he spends the last five books in this antiquariat in Mardam. But he's in. This is also what you do to find a new perspective to the stories, of course. Because I wanted his colleagues to get more involved, and then when they can't solve the case, they come to Van Veeteren in his antiquariat. So it's just a. Part of it is a trick to find new perspectives, and also to make more room for his colleagues, I think.
And what are you working on now? Are you writing a book now? And if so, what?
Yes, I'm writing this. What am I writing now? I'm writing. Yeah, it's only one book at a time, but I'm writing a story from London actually, because I went. There are number three of the Barbarotti series was out last year. And this autumn, in August, my book. I spent 2 years in New York, and there is a book called The Worms of Carmine Street, which is out. It's a standalone, and you find it in this pamphlet that you are either sitting on or have in your lap. This pamphlet is it's constructed by my Swedish publisher. You will notice that he's a Bob Dylan. He's a freak generally, but he's also a Bob Dylan freak. So you have a lot of hidden clues to Bob Dylan and 100 hidden clues to dogs in this. But this book is about my standalones, and the book the Worms of Carmine Street is in there. But the next one out in Sweden is this New York book, and then I'm writing now is the London book, which I just started. But
so
next year number four Barbarotti is out. This is a but I'm.
So I get it. So New York book, London book. Tax deductible visits.
Ooh, I'm not sure about that. My wife runs these things, but
that's what that's about.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I'm pretty well out of questions, so I'm sure that we'll have loads in the audience here. So I'm going to throw it open. Yes, Janet. Can we have the mic? Because we can. It's a big room, and we can't hear.
I can talk very loud. Oh. I've just been looking at this, and you were kind enough to say that, or is it because I picked it up, the handwritten manuscript, The Worms of Carmine Street. I work directly onto a computer because I cannot read my handwriting. How do you read your handwriting?
You have to do it, you mustn't wait too long, because I lose it within 3 days. Also, but can you read Swedish?
A little,
yeah. No, it's true. I mean, if I write something and I wait for 2 months, I couldn't be able to decipher it after. So what I generally do is I write it by hand, and then the next day or the next within the next week at least, I write it out to the computer, yeah.
But you have to write it by hand, first of all.
Yes, because I'm used to it, and it's also... and all only on the right-hand side of the page, because everybody knows that it's boring to write on the left, because you can see the text through the, if you're not Japanese or something. But I mean, I only write on the right-hand side of the page, and then you can make corrections on the left-hand side. And this is the way I go about it. Yeah, but I can... well, I know sometimes I haven't been able to decipher it also, but then I make something else up.
Huh? Then it's an editing process.
It is, isn't it? Yes, of course it is. But I mean, every time that you go from handwriting to type version and from the screen and you print it and then it's a book, I think all of these stages are important, because when you see the text in a new light from one stage to the next one. So I think it's a good idea to start by hand.
Bill.
What effect does living in a country surrounded by a lot of other countries have when you're writing in your mood and the characters you develop? You know, living in the States, we're sort of surrounded by more of ourselves. But you're surrounded by various countries. Does that affect you?
You mean various countries where? In Sweden or in...
In Sweden, when you're in Sweden, yes.
Yeah. You mean I'm surrounded by various countries?
Yes, you are surrounded by.
You mean Denmark and Finland and whatever?
Anything below it, too.
Yeah, sure. Well, I haven't given that question a lot of thought, but you probably get a prize for it. Well, I don't. Where I'm writing is not important. I mean, distance sometimes is important. I mean, when I wrote a book called Piccadilly Circus is not situated in Kumla, which is a story about Sweden in the 60s, I wrote it in Australia, and 32 years later. So I think it's the distance. If you're a journalist, it's very good to. I mean, you write what you see. But when you are a writer, at least I need some distance. But I never think about that these countries are very threatening to my writing. No. But I mean, no. Or perhaps they are, but it's good that I haven't noticed.
There was a question down here, yes.
You've written about a mythical person. Sorry, a mythical... I'll shout.
Yes, it's better to, yeah.
Someone whose identity is set in a mythical country, and you've written about a Swedish-Italian person. Do you write about American or English? And if so, what do you have to bring to that study?
Well, the book about New York is definitely set in New York, and I mean, I'm surrounded by Americans. but, I mean, the story, well, you ask the questions, of course, when you start writing, what kind of a story is it? Do I need a fictitious country or do I need a real country? And I know this, the answer to these questions quite early, but I don't know why. But some stories are if you put some stories, if you put Hamlet in Montana, I'm sure it wouldn't work. For instance, this is a very bad example, but never mind. But as a writer, you know these things. Intuitive.
Characters grow out of the landscape,
yes,
where they live and where they've been born.
Yeah, in a way. But I wouldn't call Van Vieteren a mythical. He's just fictitious. He could be... It's Northern Europe. And, I mean, Americans, they don't notice that this is a fictitious country. Of course, they think it's Sweden. They think it's Europe.
Right.
Because they know... They're not very good at geography, as we all know. I had a saying... War is God's way of teaching Americans geography. Ooh, this is bad. Sorry. Sorry.
Sorry, Bill. Can we have another question, please? Somebody else had their hand up somewhere? Yes, Maxine. How long did it take you to get your first novel published?
My first one was... not very long. I was refused once, and then from Bonniers, and then the second largest publishing house in Sweden, they took it. So just 2 years. But then they refused the first crime novel, and they said, no, this is not, you're trying to write a serious crime novel, it won't work. But then I got back to Bonniers, and they, so, but not very long, no, I was lucky.
And how is it for new writers in Sweden? Because here, I think... publishing business is very, very tough. Recession.
Yeah.
It's even harder, perhaps, not just for new writers to get published, but for mid-list authors to keep their publishers. Publishers dumping authors in Sweden.
It's difficult in Sweden too. I've been lucky. I mean, but we have a different. It's a small country, and when I started out, we didn't have literary agents, for instance. You just sent your manuscript to the publishing house, and they said no, and then you sort of put up with a new title and said it in again. That's what you do, and then they have you. Sooner or later, you have a yes or a no. But it's getting more and more complicated. And I know that, for instance, Bonniers, which is my publishing house, and they are the largest in Sweden. They get 1,000 manuscripts for novel every year. And they didn't ask for these from debutants, and they publish like three of them. So it is tricky. Everybody wants to be a writer, obviously, in Sweden. But there are no easy ways about it. I mean, you need to fight for it. You need to write every word, and you. But it's tricky. Yes.
It's very difficult.
But on the other hand, I mean, I've heard that every book ever written was written after 1985. Is that true? So there are too many writers. I don't know.
Too many writers, not enough readers. But you read a lot in Sweden, don't you? Great.
Yes, we do, I think. I'm not sure compared to England. I mean, Germany, it's probably they have the largest number of readers, I think. But they're also complaining about the book market going down, etc. So I'm not sure.
It's difficult. Yeah. Yes. The question is for those of you who couldn't hear: how does the translation process work now that Hawken's becoming more popular? Would he consider writing directly into English?
No, never. Question. I wouldn't dream of writing directly into English. I mean, Beckett did it, and Ionesco did it. I mean, I have my mother tongue, and I would never dream of writing into English. But I don't know about the process, because in the first four books was a kind of a joint venture between the US and the UK, and which complicated things, of course. But now I think that I'm with Macmillan in the UK, and they can decide, because, I mean, the decision was always complicated. And Laurie Thompson, my translator, he emailed me, "Have you heard anything?" And I said, "No, I haven't." So it was a kind of a fuzz about all this. But hopefully this will... But I suppose that they will... 1 a year is what they are intending,
that's
I think.
Usually happens, yeah. So I assume that the translations will already be going on of the next book, the fifth book.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but I hope so.
So that's the question there. Yes, at the back. That's a really interesting question. The question is, are there writers who have influenced Håkan? There is that great Swedish tradition of crime writers. Were you influenced by any of those? And if not, which writers did influence you?
I don't know. I mean, you steal from everybody. That's what you do. And I mean, there are a number, and I read a lot. You really steal, you do that. But I mean, you try to do it without noticing it. But... I mean, in Sweden we have a great tradition, and I think the tradition is Sjöwall Wahlöö, which nobody can pronounce, who's not born in Sweden, but I don't think we have a great tradition, really. I mean, we are blooming now, I know, with a lot of, we sell a lot of books, but I steal from every writer.
Do you have a favorite author, Swedish?
I mean, I usually say Ian McEwan, because and I was sort of, I said in an interview in Sweden like 5 years ago, but when you pick the next Nobel Prize winner, and he's an Englishman, if you don't pick Ian McEwan, I'll get pissed off. And then after that, they picked Pinter and then and somebody else. Who was it? Lessing, yeah, sure. Two of them, without picking Ian McEwan. But I mean, he's a tremendous writer to me, Ian McEwan.
Yes, question over here.
This might make a good follow-up to the previous question. You acknowledge that Van Vieteren's name is a tribute to Jan Willem van de Wetering. You've named minor characters, Kellerman and I think Imanigo Enso.
Yeah.
Why contribute to other crime writers in that way, and why those particular crime writers?
Can I just repeat the question for people who haven't heard it? That Håkon pays tribute to other crime writers in his books by using their names. And do you do that in other books, and why? Can you explain why you do it?
Why not? I mean, somebody has to have a name, and why don't? If he's a good guy, give him a good name for somebody that you admire. So, my books are probably full with these sort of secret messages that only 1 out of 100 readers will notice. And they also say that there is a... I was born in a small place in Sweden called Kumla. It's only famous for one thing. We got the best prison in Sweden. But there are a lot of these things that only the Kumla readers will find out. Now he's talking about this. So there are a lot of small details. And it doesn't disturb the rest of the book, so why not?
So, no, I'd asked you that question before. I wanted to see if I could catch you out.
But you got roughly the same answer.
Nearly exactly.
Wonderful. I'm glad to hear it, sir.
Been asked that before. Do we have any more questions for Håkon Nesser? Yeah, Bill.
I'm interested in the mood of the Swedish people. The betrayal we have is, again, depressive. And unhappy. Is this really true, or is this something which is just selling books has become part of a publicity type? Yeah. Writing about Sweden. Is there a different image that we need to be aware of?
Did everybody hear that question? We have this stereotype of all Swedes as being incredibly depressive. Is that true?
No, it's not true. Ingmar Bergman, as I said yesterday, he helped a lot. I was in New York when he died, and he got the headline, the full first page of the New York Times, and and Antonioni died the same day, and he got 4 lines inside the paper. You shouldn't, if you're a director, you shouldn't die on the same day as Ingmar Bergman. That's bad planning. But no, we're not that depressed, but we don't talk a lot, and it's interesting with this. It fits very well into a crime story. People who sort of you store things inside and you keep them there for 30 years. And then you suddenly, for some reason, you lift the lid, and then something comes up. And this is I think you try to, when you write crime fiction, you try to put Swedes even into Belgium and to England, because these are good murderers in a way, Swedes. But we're not that depressed, really. We're just serious.
Even in midwinter, when it's dark for most of the day.
But you have a very high suicide rate.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
But I think they're mostly immigrants. They're
from New York City, right?
Yeah, they're not used to the darkness, so it's... But Sweden, Shetlands and Sweden, it's basically the same latitude. So... When I read Anne's books, it's real. I looked at the map and say, it's exactly Uppsala where I used to be. And she's talking about the light, the in June and July, the June July madness when it never gets dark. And in Sweden, you go 500 miles north. Then that's a midsummer, and that's the midnight sun. But you get. It's difficult to live in Sweden during the winter. True. Don't try.
But a great atmosphere for writing crime novels. Do we have any more questions for Håkon?
Did you discuss Peter Wallou and Marshall Wallach? Do they have any effect on you? This is my first exposure to Swedish writing 25, 30 years ago.
Yep.
And I read them all very, very eagerly and have reread some of them and still enjoy them very much. Is there a continuation of influence today, or are they just gone and part of history?
I don't think they're part of history, but everybody refers to them, but because they were so famous, but you don't write in, and they are very, very, I enjoyed it a lot. I bought those books and I loved them when they were written between 65 and 75, and then Pervale died before the last book was out. Of course, I enjoyed them immensely. But the impact is more that you want to find the tradition, but they are very political. They are enormously political. And the last word in the last book is X as in Marx. So this is very, very left-wing writing. But everybody loves a left-wing writer, is an American saying. But of course they were influential because they put Sweden on the map, sort of.
And on the screen.
Yes.
Do we have any more? Yep.
Well, you talk about yourself as a person who keeps it all here, keeps the story inside. I was just wondering, can you switch off? I mean, are you easy to live with?
The question is...
If you're in a very dark place, it's all in here.
Yeah. Yeah,
sorry, just in case people can't hear, the question was that as Håkon carries all these dark thoughts around in his head, what's he like to live with, and can he switch off?
Well, it's easy. There are two answers, and if I answer, I say, yes, I can. If you ask my wife, I say, no, he's not very good at it. but I think I can, because I've written 22 books, and you need to. But if you have if you have two chapters in your head and you don't get them written down, then you're not easy to live with, I suppose. But I'm getting better.
If you don't get the chance to write for a couple of days. Mm. Yeah.
What about you, Anne? Are you easy to live with?
I'm remarkably easy to live with.
Oh.
If we have no more questions, then I'd very much like to thank Håkon again for coming and talking to us, and for being our international guest of honour this year. So, thank you.